Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast with me, Nick Shapley. And today I'm going to be talking about the Washington Naval Conference of 1921 to 22. There's a number of reasons why I think it's important. It rather gets overshadowed by the Treaty of Versailles and the Paris Peace Conference. But the Washington Naval Conference itself is of huge significance to understanding the complexities of interwar diplomacy and the slide towards war at the end of the 1930s. The conference itself were the first major arms limitation talks, and the culture of anxiety about war, obviously, that the First World War had left behind throughout much of the world, really helps to account for the success, in a way, of the conference. Until the advent of air power and then missile technology, power was extended throughout the world by most major states using their navies, and particularly the British Empire is the case in point with this one. The British Empire throughout the 19th century had been held together through the Royal Navy and various acts of gunboat diplomacy. The Royal Navy was Britain's ace card. Britain's military power didn't so much come from mass use of manpower and armies. The First World War is something of an aberration for the British, really, and the preferred policy of the British is to have a small fighting force and a kind of a colonial defence force, but have a large navy. That navy was stretched to its very limits during the First World War and suffered the kind of the Pyrrhic victory of Jutland, losing far more ships than the Germans, but forcing the better equipped and better run German fleet from the North Sea forever. As the war was ending, the advent of air power, and particularly naval air power, was starting to make many older warships obsolete. So the vast collection of dreadnought battleships that the British had developed, and destroyers and cruisers, was becoming less and less a viable fighting force. And the British knew this. The pace of investment in things like aircraft carriers was occurring in America, was an indicator as to who the next great naval power would be. The British were mindful of this and mindful of their bankruptcy at the end of the war. They'd gone through, gone from being the world's largest creditor to the world's biggest debtor at the end of the First World War. And they knew also that the next arena of naval dispute would probably be the Pacific, and it would probably be between their old ally Japan and the USA. The treaty that the British and the Japanese had signed between themselves in 1902 had been designed really to make up for British naval weakness in the Far East. Between 1902 and 1907, a kind of diplomatic revolution happened in Britain, where she allowed herself to become tied into formal treaties, first with Japan, then in 1904 with France, and in 1907 with Russia. More actually ententes with France and Russia, agreements, but it was a formal treaty with the Japanese in 1902. And this was because really the British were starting to feel the cold at the turn of the century, and starting to feel that they really were quite vulnerable to new threats, particularly from Germany. And there was, you know, there was also a fear, and for many British diplomats, that perhaps even the Americans might be the downfall of the British Empire yet. So the vulnerability that the British found themselves in 1902 caused them to sign a naval treaty with the Japanese, and which meant that the Japanese, really, in the event of a war, would be the dominant naval power in the Pacific. And would help Britain to hang on to her imperial possessions there in return for favours rendered. And this treaty was coming to an end in 1922. Looking at the writing on the wall, the British thought that it would probably be unwise to continue this friendship with Japan, especially if that wound up dragging the Royal Navy into a war with the United States. Japan and America had increasing tensions over the Pacific, and the conference was a great way, really, of coming to an arrangement with the Americans. For their part, the Americans had no desire to have any kind of dispute with the British, and they were hoping for an end to the Anglo-Japanese Treaty, something they viewed as quite a historical aberration. They hoped that the British would help them to put pressure on the Japanese to agree to a ratio of naval ships. And the concession that they particularly wanted from the Japanese was a continuation of what was known as the open door policy in China. America had long looked to China as being the source of an immense amount of wealth and prosperity. America didn't look to officially colonise China. Instead, she saw China as a market for her products and a source of cheap raw materials. If America could have what was called the open door policy in China, then she could trade into China and use her industrial might to flood Chinese markets with manufactured goods. And, you know, there was a rather utopian belief that in some way some of the kind of the values of America, liberal democracy and free markets, would rub off on the Chinese. The Chinese would become essentially good students of Americanness. The only power that stood in the way and who dominated the Shandong Peninsula was Japan. The Japanese had successfully managed to avoid handing back any Chinese territories won from 1894 onwards, and had managed to put their position first at the Treaty of Versailles, at the Paris Peace Conference. So the Chinese already felt a sense of utter betrayal by the Western Allies. But the Japanese also had their own axe to grind as well. At the Paris Peace Conference, the Japanese had attempted to secure a commitment to racial equality particularly from Australia and from America. The rules surrounding immigration into both countries meant that the Japanese and other Asians were subject to a distinct quota. And there was a general sense of racism and intolerance towards Japanese, Chinese, Koreans and other Asians in both Australia and in America, particularly in California, where many Japanese had settled. This was something that at the Paris Peace Conference the Japanese were hoping to overturn, and were unsuccessful in that ambition. So they had a sense, really, that they weren't being treated fairly by the West, and that as a new world power, one that had been victorious over the Russians in 1905 and that had contributed to the war effort during the First World War, that they should be treated seriously and respectfully as any other European power should. Both British and American popular culture was laden with all manner of pretty unpleasant racial stereotypes of the Japanese, stereotypes which were going to be rather alarmingly overturned from 1941 onwards, and the Japanese would be a power never to be underestimated again. Now, somewhere way back in the Explaining History podcast archives, I'd done something on imperial defence between the wars, particularly on the Singapore strategy. Now, go and listen to that, because I don't want to kind of rehash too many things, too many podcasts, but ultimately, between the two world wars in the 1920s and 30s, the British were acutely aware of a growing sense of insecurity surrounding their eastern colonies, particularly Singapore, Malaya and Burma. And there was an anxiety about Japanese ambitions. The Washington Naval Conference, therefore, was extremely useful, and it meant that there was an agreement in place between Britain and the Americans as to the ascendant power in the Pacific. Far better that it be the Americans than the Japanese, was the view of the British. The Japanese were keen to have some kind of international recognition of their, what they called, special interests in Manchuria and Mongolia, and this was perhaps as much for the benefit of the Americans as it was for the Soviet Union, who were not invited to the conference. Ultimately, the agreement that's ironed out between the two powers is called the 553 ruling, meaning that for every 5 tons of shipping the Americans were allowed, the British were allowed an equivalent 5 and the Japanese 3. So this resulted in just over 500,000 tons of shipping for both Britain and America, and 330,000 or so of shipping for the Japanese. Again, this was seen as an immense slight, particularly in the growing radical nationalist circles in Japan, and those who advocated the a notion of pan-Asianism, that Japan should become the new imperial leader in Asia and should be the power to extend its control across Asia and perhaps force British, French and Dutch settlers out of Southeast Asia for good. Japan was, in the eyes of the Pan-Asianists, the power that should really be leading and shaping Asia, and treating the Malays, the Singaporeans, the Filipinos and the rest as the younger brothers who needed to be educated in modernisation in the way that Japan had successfully learned from the West. Unfortunately, the conference did very little to reduce tensions, obviously between America and Japan and between Britain and Japan, but there was still a fair old degree of suspicion between the British and the Americans as well. Just because both sides had decided that their interests were best suited with one another didn't mean that there was an immense and fraternal love-in throughout the 1920s and 30s. There were plenty in the American military and naval establishments. Admiral King, who was the head of the US Navy during the Second World War, springs to mind, who looked upon perfidious Albion with a great deal of suspicion and were quite sure that if the British went to war, they'd be looking to drag America in to help defend British colonies, as is their inimitable style. The British had similar suspicions of the Americans and looked upon the Americans as potential competitors for their world role, a world role really that by this point had long since been lost. And they looked upon the Americans as the kind of Wilsonian do-gooders who might possibly just end the idea of empire for good. The British were also mindful that America was a good place to borrow money from, and so were eager to mind their manners. One of the consequences of the Washington Naval Conference was that it really was the end of the kind of vast battle fleets that had been synonymous with the late 19th century, and the kinds of fleets that had slugged it out at Jutland. The Japanese had always banked on a titanic kind of naval battle in the Pacific with the Americans, where air power would be used for the first time, and the Japanese fleets, the Japanese battleship fleets, would then go and clear up what was left. And that's really the model for the Battle of Midway. But the British, having had the experience of Jutland, realised that this was in some ways quite desirable, and that these kinds of head-on battles were not really going to do either side any good in the long run. And there would be, it was really sort of simply rams butting heads, so to speak. So there was no reluctance on the part of the British to come to this kind of an arrangement. The Americans did continue to build battleships. The politics of the New Deal a decade later really rather demanded it. The importance of keeping shipyards open with government contracts overrode any international commitments Roosevelt's predecessors may have made. The all three powers knew that the clever thing to do was to create smaller, lighter, more powerful ships, cruisers and destroyers, to get round the tonnage issue. And also, there was, for the first time, a limit on the amount of submarines available. And the British knew quite painfully how damaging the submarine warfare against British merchant shipping had been during the war. The great innovation, however, would be the aircraft carrier. And many ships under construction during the time of the Washington Conference that were then left in the dry dock, or, you know, were potentially going to be scrapped, suddenly became aircraft carriers. And gradually, as air power became more sophisticated, it became apparent that this would be the device of the future. This would be the means of waging long-distance wars in the future. And as we can see from the eventual outcome of the Pacific War, it's the carriers that decide it, and the ability of America to repair and produce more of them at a faster rate than Japan can possibly manage. Anyway, thanks very much for listening. It's a particularly enjoyable topic. I'm fascinated by the Washington Naval Conference. Now, I had to pause the recording for a moment there because the buzzer went, and what arrived? Yes, the first batch of books from our good friends at Penguin, who are giving us a trial review slot. So I'm going to be reviewing Richard Vinen's National Service, Conscription in Britain, 1945-63, and Alexander Watson's fascinating, I can't wait to start reading this, fascinating Ring of Steel, Germany and Austria-Hungary at War, 1914-1918. So check that out in a special length explaining history review podcast next week. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you soon. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.